This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Portobello is a quiet Central American town about an hour outside its bustling neighbor, Panama City. Tourists sometimes make the 50-mile trek to take advantage of Portobello's beautiful beaches along the Caribbean coast. But every October, this little village comes alive with sights and sounds of the Festival of the Nazarene. It's an event that draws tens of thousands of people to Portobello. And the main attraction is El Cristo Negro, the Black Christ. It's a life-size statue of Jesus carved from dark mahogany that is said to have arrived in Portobello sometime in the late 17th century. Well, during the festival season, many crawl through town and approach the statue on their hands, knees, and bellies. The Black Christ figure is a celebration, and that celebration and the figure that surround all of that has become Portobello's main source of spiritual and cultural identity. It's drawn artists and academics to Panama to study unique traditions of Portobello's people. Renee Alexander Kraft has been traveling to Portobello for a decade now. She's an assistant professor of communication studies and global studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and she continues to return to Panama to explore the transformative effects of El Cristo Negro on Portobello. And I'm pleased to welcome Renee Kraft as my guest this hour. Good to have you here. How are you doing?
Thank you. Good to be here.
Tell us about El Cristo. Describe it for us.
Well, the figure itself is about a six-foot-tall figure. It's done out of a deep mahogany wood. It's been made darker with time because there are candles often burning underneath it, so it's gotten darkened. What you see of the figure's wood is its face, two hands, and one foot. It actually wasn't carved in its entirety. So part of the part that's covered in his tunic isn't fully a carved man. So its face itself has been made out of this plate. Behind the plate is, when I say plate, I mean like an iron plate. Behind the plate is glass eyes. So he's got these glass eyes. The plate is darkened to match the wood. He's carrying a cross, and he's leaned over. And he's always slightly above the altar of the church because he's about four steps up above where congregants would witness him.
And where is he kept in Portobello?
He's kept in the Church of San Felipe. So this is the main church in the middle of town.
Now, there is a number of stories about how El Cristo Negro came to Portobello. Tell us a few of them.
Well, there are three main, there are numerous stories, and they end up coalescing around three main tales. The first is that there was this horrible storm, and all of these stories take place around the mid-1600s. There's a horrible storm that caused a ship destined for elsewhere to take shelter in the Portobello Cove. It did so, but every time it tried to leave, the storm got violent again. The ship's captain decided to lower some of the weight, to release some of the weight of the ship, and got rid of some of these religious artifacts that were in a big crate, left it in the bay. As soon as he put it, you know, in the bay, the day lightened up, he was able to leave, and people in the town found the crate, found the figure, the Nazarene, Christ the Nazarene, and decided he was destined to be there. Another is that there had been a horrible epidemic, a cholera epidemic, all over Panama, and that when the figure arrived, again, the figure would have been destined for elsewhere, Portobello itself was spared, and that people prayed for an end of the epidemic, they prayed for their health, and the Christ listened to them. So this then spawned pilgrims from all over the place to pray and ask their brother Jesus for help, for forgiveness, for help. And a final one is that there was a switch. There was one church that was located on a small island on the Pacific side of Panama who'd ordered Christ of Nazareth. Another church, the church in Portobello, had ordered an image of Santo Domingo. And that both of them were being ordered from the same shop in Spain. On their way there, either they were tagged incorrectly in Spain, or they just were switched when they were left. So when the Christ figure appeared in Panama, they tried several times to give it back to where it originally belonged, but it wouldn't go. So they ended up, in this narrative, they end up compensating the other church for their lost statue, and they maintain the Christ figure. But in each of them, there's some natural event that happens. The Christ figure arrives. He will not leave, or every time people try to get him to leave, something bad happens. He's meant to be in Portobello.
That's the remarkable thing about all the stories, is that initially he was not meant, that
right.
this was never destined for Portobello.
Exactly.
But ultimately, the statue says, and Christ says, I'm staying right
exactly.
here.
Exactly. He chooses Portobello.
And the port itself has a remarkable history. Back in the 17th century, when El Cristo Negro arrived, it was a bustle. It was probably the most important city in Panama.
Very much so. Around this time, Panama, Portobello specifically, is one of the jewels in the Spanish crown. This is where, in the Spanish colonial empire, goods are being transitioned back and forth, goods and people. So you've got gold and silver coming from Peru. You've got made goods coming from Europe. You have these huge ferias de Portobello, these huge Portobello fairs where goods are being exchanged during this period.
So it's a very important place in the colonial trade routes.
Very
and
much so.
It's a bustling place. But that changed.
Yes.
How so? What happened?
Well, part of it was a victim of its own success. So pirates and privateers started to sack Portobello in the way that they had done Nombre de Dios, which was part of the seat of power before power moved to Portobello. And so as pirates were robbing the aduana and robbing the area, it wasn't useful anymore to have the fairs there. And the town emptied out. It became a ghost of itself, because without that kind of commerce, without that kind of energy, a lot of the colonials in that area moved away.
However, the statue remained.
It did.
We've been calling it, or I've been calling it, El Cristo Negro. That's the way it's known the world over, but not in Portobello.
Right. It actually, it's, you know, I love the statue's history in terms of how it's come to mean what it means. When it came there, it was known as the Nazarene. It's just one of the representations of Christ. It happens to be done in this deep wood, but he is just Christ. In Portobello, people call him the Nazarene, El Nasa. Around the end of the Second World War, soldiers disembarked in Portobello from the U.S. to give thanks, to be part of this pilgrimage. And as a part of the pilgrimage, you know, part of the way the story goes, they were so excited. Some say that these were African-American soldiers who were excited. Some don't give them a racial identity at all. So we're left to know that they're just soldiers from the U.S. They're part of this procession, and they get so excited, they say, Viva el Cristo Negro! And the name sticks.
Well, I think that is such an important part of the story, the way this statue, the identity of the town and the identity of the people has changed and sort of reconfigured over time. That and the festival itself, which
right.
gets underway there tomorrow. We'll talk more about that as we continue our conversation about the Festival of the Black Christ, an annual event that takes place in Panama in the city of Portobello. My guest is Renee Kraft, a writer and professor at UNC. And you are listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. This hour, we're talking about the Festival of the Black Christ in Portobello, a small town in Panama. The annual event draws tens of thousands of people to see a life-size figure of Christ carved from dark mahogany wood. Renee Alexander Kraft is with me in the studio, an assistant professor in the Department of Communication Studies and Curriculum in Global Studies at UNC. Renee, describe this festival for us? What goes on in the street?
Well, the festival itself, it peaks around the 21st of October, so it'll peak tomorrow. For a couple of weeks leading up to it, you've got pilgrims who start walking from all over Panama. Some of them are native Panamanians who are walking. Others come from elsewhere, either back home or just to be part of the festival. The Black Christ's or El Nazareno's color is purple. So people often wear purple tunics as they walk into town. So you have kind of, it starts with a trickle, little by little, weeks leading up to it. By this time, you've got big groups of people coming into the town, wearing their purple tunics. Some are store-bought, some are homemade. Many, when they get close to the town, start coming in on their hands and knees. There's a procession that leads into town and then straight into the church. All around the procession, though, you have all these different stands, people selling their wares, people selling, you know, beer, people selling trinkets with Black Christ figure on it, T-shirts, El Cristo Negro, or Viva El Nazareno. And there's an air of celebration, especially on the 21st. And it's a wonderful mix of sacred and secular. You've got the people who are coming into the church who are praying and asking God and Jesus for these very important things, or giving thanks for some huge blessing that they've experienced. And you've got people in the town who are cheering them on this last leg of the way. So the carnivalesque atmosphere, part of it is a celebration. You made it. You've come from wherever you've come from. You've made it into town. You're almost at the church. So it is that kind of great mixing. There are, these days, between 40 and 60,000 people who end up coming.
And the population of the town otherwise is?
The population, in terms of the center of the town, you only have a couple of hundred people. In terms of Portobello, the district, the larger area, you've got about 4,000. Wow. So this really bloats the town, especially the center of the town. The main area of the town is no bigger than the main area of Chapel Hill's campus. It's a point of reference I often use. So an anecdote I share sometimes is when I'm there and staying in one of the houses, I can be on the other side of this central part of town and still someone can go get me for a phone call. It's a very kind of small, intimate space in terms of the center.
And then 40,000 people, four times the total number of the area, not just that center town, show up. Well, I know you're working on a novel now. Your forthcoming novel is called When the Devil Knocks, and it describes the experience of those who make this long pilgrimage. And I wonder if you can read an excerpt for us right now.
Oh, I would love to. So the excerpt I'll read is about one of the main characters who has been a part of this tragedy. And he's never participated in the festival before, but he needs to. He needs to talk very intimately to Christ. And so the excerpt starts with him entering the town. When Luis limped up the final hill leading into Portobello, the tendons in his legs felt as though someone had sawed them apart with a broken beer bottle. He'd been traveling with a group of pilgrims from Panama City for 3 days. Sweat molded the purple tunic his mother made for him to his torso like papier-mâché, and his shorts wrung themselves around his legs like dingy wash rags. He let mosquitoes eat him without swatting them and breathed in deeply, even when the air was thick with urine and gasoline. Luis and his friends had been coming to celebrate the October 21st Festival of Jesus de Nazareno, El Cristo Negro de Portobello, for years, but this was his first time making a pilgrimage. It was his manda, his plea for forgiveness, and his sacrifice. He needed to reconnect with El Nazareno, his brother, his savior, his protector. Not far, he thought. Not far now. He blinked hard each time sweat dripped from his forehead into his eyes. The back of his terracotta hand rose instinctively to wipe away the stinging, but only added dirt and soot to the mixture. It didn't matter anyway. Everything hurt. Luis felt dizzy and faint. He shook his head. Several times he thought he might pass out. Once, with absolutely no fear, he thought he might die. But he didn't. He shook his head again. A hand shoved a water bottle at him. He drank 3 big gulps, poured the rest over his head, and got down on all fours. The heavy woman who gave Luis water wiped his face with her pink Hello Kitty towel, cracked the seal of a new water bottle, and offered him more. He took it and drank. She had stuffed herself inside purple spandex pants and a Viva el Cristo Negro t-shirt, with Jesus stretched almost as wide as he was tall. No hay dolor, she reassured him. There is no pain.
Renee Alexander Kraft reading from her forthcoming novel, When the Devil Knocks. Renee is an assistant professor in the Department of Communication Studies at UNC and has spent a lot of time studying the people of Portobello in Panama and the Cristo Negro, or El Nazarene, as they say in Portobello, a remarkable figure, a carved figure that's been there since the 16th century. Is mortification a part of the way you honor this saint, the statue, the idea of dripping wax on your back and crawling on your knees? This is all part of the way you pray.
Part of it is, you know, it links to other traditions. I know that there are various traditions in different parts of Spain, in Sevilla, for example, where people enter into approach a statue in that same kind of way. You are willing to submit yourself to a certain kind of pain, because no pain that you experience would be as great as the pain of Christ who died for you. So you're making the you're making your manda, you're making your prayers, you're allowing yourself to be present, radically present, for every part of this pain.
It's interesting that this goes back to, as you say, that there are analogs to ceremonies or ways of honoring statues in Spain. But also, this was a port city.
Right.
It was active in the slave trade.
Yes.
The population then becomes mixed. What customs and spiritual ideas and identities are reflected now in Portobello in the honoring the statue?
Well, you have a pretty mixed community right now. Although the majority, if you look at statistics, the major population in Panama identify as Catholic. The major population in Portobello also identify as Catholic, but that doesn't translate into activity necessarily. So you have some people who are active in this Catholic church. You have Protestant churches that are active in Portobello, and then different kind of spiritual practices. In terms of the way it translates in the church and with the Black Christ figure or El Nazareno, there are times when the Congo tradition, another very deep-seated tradition which reflects an Afro-Latin population in Panama, gets fused very much so with the Catholic activity in the town and with its participation with the Catholic Church.
This business of identity, too, and the town's identity is an interesting one, and again, all wrapped up in the statue itself. Because, as you say, the people in town call it El Nazarene.
Mm-hmm.
But people from outside not only call it the Black Christ, but they had another name for it, especially in Central and Latin America. And that is?
In terms of the...
The name of the statue. It was called the Gangster, right? The Gangster,
well,
or
know,
the Gangster Saint? Or?
Right. It actually ends up being called that by different Panamanians as well. Some people call it Jesús de los Malientes, which is kind of the saint of the gangsters, or the saint of the lowly in this sense. But that's been reappropriated in Panama. There's no way that kind of naming doesn't have some kind of racial and class tinge to it. But people in the town reappropriate it to say, well, this is Jesus, and Jesus chose me. He could have been in any of your towns, but he's not. He chose Portobello, and he chose the Portobellanian people. So he is our Jesus.
It is an interesting reflection, though, about and a sort of an obvious reflection of how various classes in the area and even within Panama view that place, where they might not feel comfortable talking in terms of class. They're very easily sort of slap a new name on the statue and identify the whole town with that.
Right. And what makes that even more interesting for me is thinking back to this is a figure who would have come in the town, again, in the mid-1600s. So at the time, the population of the town, you've got a strong colonial presence that's controlling the town. And the black population is mainly an enslaved presence, though there are free blacks in the town. By the time the church that he's in now, his current structure is built, you've got, this is around the 1820s, you have Spain abolishing slavery in all of its colonies. You have the population of Panama at the time really 90% black, and mostly free blacks, either from the Cimarrones who ran away to the hills and rainforest and then came back to populate the town as colonialists, colonists left. So it's interesting that at the time he arrived as this Nazarene, as this Christ, he would have just been a figure in the church. He would not have had the same kind of racial nexus that he does now.
And the fact that he is black is simply the material that he's made from. He's carved out of mahogany.
Right. He's carved out of a deep wood, which, again, over time, there are these I don't know at what point glass was put in front of him on the altar, but there are these rows of candles that burn right in front of him. And so he's been darkened by that over time as well. And it's very interesting and, I think, healthy, the way the townspeople have honored him, appropriated him, and tell his story.
Well, it's as though the statue's identity has evolved with the town itself,
yeah.
Which is pretty amazing. And of course, then this celebration, year after year, a pilgrimage to El Nazarene, would also include music like this.
Party, you're my sonero, llévame a cortar manzo.
Now, this is music of the Congo people of Portobello. You began to tell us a little bit about him. Tell us about the music and how that plays a part in the festival.
Well, the festival itself, as people are entering the town, there are the atmosphere is full of all kinds of music. So you've got reggaeton, you've got reggae, you've got salsa, merengue. People often spontaneously begin congadas and play Congo music. And Congo, people who call themselves Congo and the Congo tradition is one of the mainstays of Portobello as well. So you get that being part of the celebration in that sense. And the music itself sometimes forms part of the atmosphere. At about 8 o'clock in the evening, after people have pilgrimaged to the statue itself, he ends up being brought out of the side door of the church. And he's held on a pillar, generally by 40 men who are belly to back, swaying, taking two steps forward and one step back, marching through the town. You've got a band behind him, playing music. And it often reminds me of New Orleans, a New Orleans style band. You've got pilgrims in front of him marching. And the atmosphere of the town in terms of the celebration has all of these different musical markers that are about the town's identity. And one of them is Congo.
Is this a celebration that is now performed largely for tourists, or is it something that still has a kind of indigenous embedded meaning for the people of Portobello?
It very much has an embedded meaning for the people of Portobello. It is not at all done. It is a festival that exists in conversation with tourists necessarily because it always involved pilgrims. But people in the town very much take part of it and take huge pride and ownership in it. And in the scene I was mentioning where you have these men walking down the street carrying the Christ figure, you have more men wanting to carry him than there's space. So, and he's very heavy. The pillar he's on then is, I say pillar, but I mean this big board that mm-hmm. he's on is very heavy. It's got the figure itself plus all these different candles and flowers and adornments. And so as a man starts to look tired, the figure takes breaks often. Another comes in, pushes him out of the way, and takes it himself. So this is very much, a festival that is about the town, about its relationship to the larger Panama and the larger country of Panama, and part of its relationship to the global community.
Including music, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. And this remarkable figure, because as these men walk, you say two steps forward and one back.
And remember, really, I'm saying two, but it's three steps forward, these three lunging steps forward and two steps back.
And two steps back. And remember, the figure itself is kind of is holding a cross
exactly.
and bent over. So it has the effect of this kind of Christ on the march.
Exactly. It looks like Christ bearing a heavy cross, walking and swaying in the town. And because the eyes are made of glass with all the flames flickering underneath, it gives the eyes so much life. And it makes the eyes look at times as though they're weeping or as though they're struggling. It's this part of it is really awe-striking to see.
We're talking about the Festival of the Black Christ in Panama and cultural traditions of the Congo people. My guest is Renee Kraft, a writer and professor at UNC. Just ahead, our conversation continues with a look at how tourism and Panama have affected the Congo customs. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking this hour about the Festival of the Black Christ in Panama. It's an event that brings tens of thousands of people to the tiny Central American community of Portobello. It happens each October. My guest is Renee Alexander Kraft, who has examined the impact of global tourism on Portobello and its cultural traditions. Renee is a professor of communication studies and global studies at UNC. You talked about this conversation, you said, between tourists and the people of Portobello. How do they manage to sort of keep control of this, the festival itself and the traditions around it with all of this worldwide attention?
Well, with the festival itself, I think that because it is, although it builds up over several weeks, it is a one-day festival, and they treat it as such. So they host the people who are coming through. You have both local folks and folks from outside who are selling their wares, who are participating in both the sacred and secular aspects of it. And then the town empties out. So what it requires of the town is, you know, a sense of hospitality for a minute, and then the extra work of cleaning up a festival, because people leave their trash and beer bottles and, you know, all of this stuff that has to be orchestrated. So at the same time, it brings more people in who are eating at the restaurants, who are buying local goods, who are helping to make the economy of Portobello more robust, if only for that moment.
I would think it would have a pretty good effect on the economy then overall.
Yeah,
I mean,
they've
come to depend on this pretty much, or are there other industries and other ways of making a living?
There are other industries and other industries and other ways of making a living. This is one of the main, it is billed in tourist literature as one of the main, you know, focal points. It's a time to get to go. But otherwise, you've got the Congo tradition, which people come to see. Tourism is part of Portobello's fabric, though Portobello doesn't always benefit from that monetarily. When I say that, I mean oftentimes you have cruise ships that come into Colón. Portobello is part of the state of Colón, but it is a city in that area. So people dock in Colón City. They then take a bus to Portobello and they walk through. It means the money then goes to the ship company or the organization, sometimes Colón 2000, this organization that helps orchestrate some of this, tourism bureaus, etc., but it doesn't necessarily stay in the town. Or small cruise ships come into the port. They're people disembark, walk around the town, but often don't go to the restaurants, don't buy things in the town because they're just there to make a quick tour, and then they'll have their lunch or dinner back on their ships. So it is one of the times that keeps people in Portobello for a sustained period where they're not rushing back off, you know, for a bus trip or not rushing back off to catch a ship.
Forgive me, but I'm sorry. This is not the only celebration or festival.
No.
By a long shot. And I talk about a couple of them, but Carnival is a very interesting celebration because there are characters
yes.
that who are passed down through generations, been very important characters.
Right.
Tell us about those.
Well, central to the town is a group of, this is very much an an Afro-Latin town, and you've got the tradition of the Congos, which links back to the Cimarrones. And we talked a little bit about that earlier, people who had escaped to the hills and rainforest from enslavement and then often repopulated the town along with other freed blacks. The Congo tradition itself honors this tradition of tricking back on Spanish colonial rule. You know, one of the things that we say about the Cimarrones is they were very smart about the notion, as Arturo Lindsay says, knowing the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So they watched the fact that the English pirates and privateers coming in were frustrating the Spanish enterprise and often helped the pirates rob the Spanish until they were able to get their own freedom in Panama. So the Congo tradition honors that sense. But it also tricks back on the Spanish colonial enterprise in another way. It is a tradition very much about parody. So it's got a king, a queen, a pajarito, who's the son of the king and the queen, and represents, he's a little bird. He represents a go-between between the royal family and a character of the devil. You've got members of the Congo community. And Congos, in this sense, they're two trajectories of what that might mean. Congo was often used in the generic way that Negro was in the States, so it could mean any black person. But also a large number of enslaved people at one point could have come from one of the Congo kingdoms on the continent of Africa. And so you've got Congos who represent kind of the innocent blacks. You've got the character of the devil who represents the enslaver, who would have beaten, you know, the enslaved population. And one of the things that they play with is the notion that in colonial times, blacks were kept in place, kept in enslavement, partially by saying, if you run away, the devil, the Christian devil, will come after you. Some of the oral history of the town talks about you know, people who would have dressed in red costumes and run into the hills and rainforest to try to trick Cimarrones back into the town. So they play with this image and turn it on its head.
So you get the colonial powers, first of all, turning Christianity on its head.
Exactly.
Trying to somehow rationalize this very unchristian institution, slavery, and they do it through the devil. And
right.
Now the Congos come back and say, all right, here's how that game is played.
Exactly.
I guess, right?
Exactly. So in their scenario, the figure of the devil chases these innocent Congos. The queen is the seat of power, the king and the queen both. But when the Cimarrones ran away to the hills and rainforest and formed their independent communities, these palenques, men often had to leave the palenques to protect it. So they were away from the center itself. So the queen, in that sense, women were the seat of culture and power within the palenque because they stayed home while the men were going out to protect the space. So in the drama, the Congo drama, and all of this happens around carnival season, right before the beginning of Lent. So this drama culminates on Ash Wednesday. You've got the devil coming to take the queen. So he comes to take the queen. The Congos play with him, thwart his efforts. And in the end, he's the one who's captured and sold. Captured, demasked, de-whipped, and sold away in the way that enslaved people were captured, Christianized, and sold.
That's an amazing way to recapture your identity after and then sustain your identity. So
yes.
This drama that's played out year after year is a way of establishing and reinforcing an identity in the face of a lot of pressure to change.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, it's an interesting time in that when the tradition is done during carnival season, it very much is for the community. Portobello is not a community that has local hotels, you know, all these hotels. There is a hotel some distance down the road that people can stay at, but at a certain time, the buses stop running, and you can't get back and forth from that easily.
So for carnival, we don't have the huge influx, the
no.
number of pilgrims. This is really a community event because this might be happening in communities all around the area.
Right.
So there's no reason to go to Portobello. We got one in our community.
Exactly. It's happening all along the Atlantic coast. And so each Congo community is having its own celebration. Congos visit one another during carnival season. People visit the various traditions in the community, but at a much smaller rate. And the visiting is more on a local level than it is on a global level. So at any time during carnival season, you'll have only a handful of global tourists in Portobello, a very, very small amount compared to the Festival of El Nazareno.
That's very much a family thing when it takes place at carnival time. And then we're talking about reinforcing and remembering a tradition, and yet a lot of global popular culture has also grown out of this, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah, very much so. So in the song you all played earlier, there are versions of Congo songs that are now remixed with reggaeton music. Panama is one of the spaces that reggaeton comes from. You've got this wonderful mix of West Indian populations who are listening to reggae music at a certain period, and you've got, and still, and you've got an Afro-Latin population who are listening to salsa and merengue and speaking Spanish. And so you get this birth of reggaeton music that's happening in Panama, that's happening in New York, that's happening in, you know, Puerto Rico, all at the same time.
All echoing back and forth. And how did you get interested in Portobello and the culture of the Congo people and this festival?
I was, this was back in 1998. I was a student in the Department of Communication Studies at UNC. And Arturo Lindsay came and made a presentation.
And tell us, we've mentioned his name a couple of times.
Yes.
But again, tell us who he is.
He's a professor of art and art history at Spelman College. And he has been studying, he's from Panama, moved to the U.S. as a teenager, and his work deals with Black aesthetics around the diaspora, Santeria traditions, Black Christ traditions in the Americas, Africanisms in the Americas. And so he had come to UNC, brought through the Institute of African American Research to do this presentation on the Black Christ figure. And as he was making his presentation, I was astonished. At the time, I'd also been an undergrad at UNC, so I've been there a long time, off and on. I'd taken all these courses around Black diaspora identity, transatlantic slave trade, Blackness in the Americas, and I hadn't yet encountered Panama. And so I'd just never given it much of a thought. I'd not thought about the ways in which these cultural traditions and crossroads touched, you know, this very important space. So when I saw these pictures, I saw people who looked like my aunts, uncles, cousins, but who, you know, spoke Spanish. And I saw this town that reminded me of a rural southern coastal town. And I just had to go there.
And you took your mother there?
I did. Not on the first visit. The very first visit, I went by myself. I'd you know, come to Arturo and said, please, I know you have this art colony. Spelman has an art colony that goes back and forth to Portobello. And I said, I'm not a visual artist, but I'm a poet. You know, I want to be an ethnographer because I did at the time, but I hadn't started, you know, my work. And I said, please, you know, I just want to go. I want to know more about the Congo tradition and more about these folks. I went there the first time in 2000. And then I entered grad school knowing, my PhD program, knowing precisely what I wanted to study. It had to be about the Congos. It had to be about Panama. And I got a Fulbright to get to go and do some of my dissertation research. While I was there that time, I begged my mom and dad to come visit because they'd seen me go back and forth and they worry, as parents do, about their children, you know, traveling globally. And it didn't matter my pictures, my stories. They could only get a partial picture, and I just wanted them to come. So they did. It was my mom's first passport. It's a huge, huge thing. My parents are now in their late 70s, early 80s. And one of the most precious moments for me was getting to introduce my parents to people in the town. Until then, I kind of was a researcher who fell out of the sky in some ways. I didn't have a, you know, they had my stories of connections to other people, but you don't see me connected to other people. And I'd met their families, and I really wanted them to get to meet mine. So I took my parents door to door to meet some of the people I'd been interviewing and working with. And although most of the people they met spoke Spanish and they spoke English, they had conversations back and forth with each other through gesture, through, you know, intent. And at the beginning of my mom's second day there, she stood on the balcony of the house we were staying in, which is owned by a wonderful artist named Sandra Eleta, who generously allows the Art Colony to utilize her space. My mom said, I know why you come here. I know why you love this place. She said, it reminds me of the Charlotte of my youth. Because my parents had grown up in Charlotte at a time when it was segregated and when they lived in small black communities where you could, where everybody knew each other. It was nothing to let your child, go outside and roam from house to house because they were going to be in a community with aunts and uncles and sisters and neighbors and people who would love them and care about them. And Portobello as a small town has that feel. Small children can go, you know, you can let your child go outside of the house and go where they will. To an outsider, it may look like children roaming free, but it's never that. There's always some loving eyeball on them because it's a small, close
community. Those connections keep getting made. Renee, thanks so much for being on the program.
Oh, thank you. This was a pleasure.
Renee Kraft is an assistant professor in the Department of Communication Studies and the curriculum in Global Studies at UNC Chapel Hill, and she has a forthcoming book that we will look forward to and have you back when that book is published.
Oh, I love that.
This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.